Today's scripture is Ecclesiastes 4:4-12 and Luke 6:1-15. Pew Bible pages are 576 and 909 and 10. And I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person, envy of another. This is too meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a small man alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were content with his wealth. For whom I was tolling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This is too meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up, but pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Now, Luke 16:1-15. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig any. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I will do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. He replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted surely for the people of his world, made sure in dealing with their own kind that are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest will very little also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you the property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your heart. What people value highly is dishonorable in God's sight.
I begin with an apology. You look at the sermon title, Management 101. Isn't that particularly yawn-worthy? It's one of those classes in college you do not sign up for unless, you know, you're going to get an easy A. Otherwise, I'm going to be sitting in the back of that classroom and nodding off. And yet, at the same time, we think, how often are we involved in keeping up with a budget? And how do we approach that? When you walk to the mailbox, you open it up, you think, well, surely I'll have something interesting this time, and you pull out that Duke Energy bill, or the cable bill, or the telephone bill, or any of the other bills that pursue you. How do you feel about it? We think about that daily task, certainly a weekly task of keeping up with a budget. We each have our different spheres of influence, different spheres of responsibility. Some of those might be smaller than others. Some of us may be working at companies where we're involved in significant budgets and the moving around of large sums of money. And we realize whether it's on a small scale or a large scale, we still face similar temptations. Certainly, there are two major temptations that keep pursuing us as human beings. One we've talked about before. A couple Sundays back, we spoke about the prodigal son. What does he do when he inherits his wealth from his father? He goes out and spends it on wanton living. We've got all sorts of images about what that might mean. We think about lottery winners these days, or we fantasize about, well, what would we do if we won a lottery? And all those ways where we had just burned through the money in an irresponsible kind of way. It's one way of approaching a budget. Another way is hoarding money. We all perhaps have people in our families, if we are not this individual ourselves. Whenever you have that paycheck come in, you make sure it goes right into the bank. Or if there is a chance to go out to eat, that person is tabulating the bill quickly in his or her mind, thinking about, well, I'm going to order water. I'm going to make sure nobody orders an appetizer. I'm going to make sure that everyone orders something under $7. We think about that kind of personality as well. That certainly is a way to approach a budget. And certainly if we had a chance to talk about it and bring to mind images that we associate with that, many of us would immediately think of Ebenezer Scrooge. The popularity of the Christmas Carol and Scrooge's desire to hold on to his money, even to the point where he won't even burn a piece of coal in the office to keep his worker Bob Cratchit warm. So we have these images on one side, somebody who completely is liberal with the budget and burns through it and then finds him or herself in a state of emergency. Well, what do I do now? Or the person on the other side who's so miserly about it, there's no possibility to enjoy any of the resources that are there. So I want you to have these images in mind when we approach this parable this morning. Because this is one of those parables where we pause after we hear it and think, what in the world's going on? This doesn't make any sense. And yet, when we get to the end of it and we consider some possibilities and relate it back to how do we handle a budget, I hope we'll come closer to some sense of meaning for you with this parable. So this is Luke chapter 16. This is immediately following those famous parables in Luke 15 about the lost coin, the lost sheep, the lost sons. This parable opens in a way that so many other parables open, with a rich person, a landowner, and a manager, a house manager who is in charge of these things. Also, another detail that doesn't surprise us, we see this in many parables as well, the manager is not the most trustworthy of individuals. The parable begins saying there is this accusation out there that the manager is wasting the resources. So remember that first case scenario of someone who burns through the money? This is what this manager is like. He doesn't value his master's property. So, the master does what we would expect. He invites him in to give him a chance to give an accounting, but evidently the master's already researched this, knows that these things are true, because he invites him in, gives him only a moment to speak before telling him, I'm firing you. Pack your bags and go. The parable then, though, shifts to the manager. And he's left in this situation. And we think about the ways we might respond in this situation. If a boss fires us, what's our first gut reaction? Probably anger. Like, how dare you treat me that way? And yet that's not really what's going on here in this parable. This individual doesn't respond in that kind of rage that we would expect. Instead, he's more on the side of worry. Okay. What am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? He starts thinking about this. The wheels start turning and he says, well, I've got just a little while here left with my master's resources. What can I do? I have the books here. I need to start thinking about the future. This is something he's never done before. He's been spending money willy-nilly, using the resources however he wants to live in the moment, to live things up. And now he's thinking about the future. What am I going to do? So he invites those who owe money to his master in, and he says, well, let me curry their favor. Let me win friends and influence people in these last moments in this job. So if you're on the other side, and the debtor or the debt collector invites you in and says, well, I want to negotiate a deal with you. How are you going to feel? Pretty excited about this. You're going to be listening. Okay. And then you think about this from the manager's perspective. You start saying, okay, well, this person coming in has quite a lot of influence, social influence here. So I'm going to make sure we forgive 50% of his debt. The next candidate who comes in, he doesn't have quite as much influence, so I'll forgive 20% of his debt, but he'll still feel like he owes me. That progresses for a while until the master figures out about this. The landowner figures out what's going on. He invites the manager back in and he says, and we think about this, what do we expect him to say? What do we expect him to say? We feel a scolding coming on. We've read so many parables where the person gets thrown into prison. And there you'll stay until you can repay every penny. Yet that's not what happens here. Instead, the master says, I'm impressed. I'm impressed that you were able to pull that off in these last moments. Jesus quickly segues into teaching, so it's hard to tell what's the end of the parable and when his commentary on the parable starts. But there is that sense that never in the parable is there an approval of the theft, of the wickedness. But what is praised is the steward finally starting to think about relationships with other people in his community and to plan for the future. That is what is praised. And Jesus goes on from there to say that there are two groups. There are those who belong to this world, and then there are the children of the light. He distinguishes here. And he says this parable portrays someone who belongs to that first group, the people of the world. And what Jesus says here is even those who belong in this world can be shrewd in the way they manage things. Okay. And so we pause there and we think about that for a moment. Does that add any clarity to this parable? It's still kind of murky, isn't it? But I want you to think about this perhaps like a coach in a particularly impassioned halftime speech. praising the other team, talking about all the things the other team did in that first half. Praising their gumption, their energy, their skill. What then does that do to his own team? Okay. So think about that for a moment. Perhaps Jesus is doing that in this parable and saying, children of light, those who belong to my kingdom, look and see how a shrewd manager works within this world and how he does everything he can in those last moments to try to plan for the future and to build relationships and to use his budget or his master's budget, but the access that he has to these resources to further those relationships. And so what is the implied question, just like the coach praising the other team, saying, well, if they're able to do that, and there are opponents, or this is the team that you need to get off of and come over to our team, as in this case, the worldly team and the children of light, what they're able to accomplish. But think about all we could accomplish if we had the same kind of energy and we used our resources in a positive way. Okay. Jesus, of course, here is continuing logic, teaching that we see elsewhere in the Bible, notably in the book of Ecclesiastes. Once again, Ecclesiastes has this listing of all the different things in life that in the end will prove empty, that are not trustworthy to devote yourself, your entire energy and life toward these things. Pleasure is one of those. But work, hard work, and money are on this list of things that fundamentally will fail you if you devote your life to them. And we heard that in this passage in Ecclesiastes. This passage also goes on to say that if money is your sole end, then you're going to end up like Ebenezer Scrooge. You're going to cut off all your relationships. And when you are left by yourself, then in practical terms, in Ecclesiastes is very practical. In practical terms, if you fall down, no one will be there to help you up. If you're cold, there'll be no one to snuggle with to keep you warm. And then there, if you find yourself in need of defense because someone is attacking you, you'll be left to your own resources. You won't be able to call on an ally to help you when it's time to defend yourself. And so those are very practical kind of things. And certainly Jesus would affirm those, but Jesus is calling us to go a step beyond that, beyond practicality, beyond that into the kingdom of God. So Jesus is not finished with this parable. He moves on to saying, and these are very famous verses, if you're faithful in little, if you have a little budget and you're faithful in that, then you would also be trustworthy in a large budget. But if you have a little budget and you burn through it or you hoard it, then you're going to do the same kind of thing if you have a large budget. And then Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Here, of course, we think about 1 Timothy 6:10. The love of money is the root of all evil. And we draw to mind those images. We know these. I'll be preaching to the choir here. We know of your generosity as a congregation. And yet at the same time, we still have time and time again people who get to the end of their lives, who look back and say, well, I wish I had not wasted so much time worrying about my budget, worrying about the checks and writing doing the electronic payments. I wish I had not spent so much time with that and instead had invested more time in my family and in my friends. And certainly here, Jesus is calling us in that direction. How do we use the resources that are given to us? And so this parable calls us to ask ourselves, how devoted are we to giving our time and attention, our money, our resources to building relationships rather than to gather more money? You've heard me make several references to Ebenezer Scrooge as this progresses, and I think this is a good way to segue into another story that may add more light to this parable and to Jesus' commentary. We know this story very well. It's been part of the Christmas culture that comes out. It's called A Christmas Carol, after all. Charles Dickens wrote this back in the 1800s. We have here a vision that has become a secular vision, and yet Dickens himself was a Christian, and there are Christian overtones throughout this. Dickens himself was a master with names. Ebenezer Scrooge. And we think about misers, and we think about Scrooge, and that name locks in. One of my teachers at Furman, though, was a specialist in Dickens, and he said, well, that causes us to skip over his first name. And his first name is Ebenezer, and it's a biblical name. And you look back, Samuel raises a little memorial to God's help in one of the Israelite victories. And it's called an Ebenezer. And you think about this, that there is God's help. Ebenezer means God's help. And so throughout this, we see the kind of person Scrooge is on his own. But then if you see the opportunities of the ghost of Christmas past, present, future, we spend so much time thinking about how the ghost of Christmas future scares Scrooge with the tombstone. And yet we lose touch with what those other ghosts are doing throughout that story. They're reminding Scrooge, you had all these opportunities in your youth. You had all those relationships. You were even engaged to be married. And what happened? Those went by the wayside because you were so concerned with money. Then the ghost of Christmas present. These are all the relationships that are out here right now that you're ignoring. Think about what you could do if you connected with those people. And then the ghost of Christmas future, not only that tombstone and the scaring of Scrooge, but also saying, well, Tiny Tim dies, Bob Cratchit is struggling, all these kinds of things that will happen if you ignore those relationships. And so here we come back to Jesus' parable saying, what energy do we invest in the relationships around us? And do we invest in those relationships in the same kind of way that we're worried about our checkbook and worried about our jobs and worried about how we're going to pay the bills? Jesus himself calls us in this parable and in these words towards Management 101. Management is not about the resources. Management is not about the money. Management is about people in God's kingdom. Management is about the future. What resources lie in front of you this day, this week? I would ask you to pause and consider on this Sabbath day. Look for ways this week to pursue those relationships with an energy and an excitement, to pursue them as good stewards, as Christ calls you. This morning we come now to our time of invitation and commitment, a time for you to consider where your energies go. What are you investing in? The resources that you have, and it may involve money. It may be like that TV commercial that you may have seen recently about the man who's so concerned about his dream car. He talks it up among his family and he grows old and he doesn't really have the money to buy it. And then he becomes a grandfather. And then he buys a car for his granddaughter. And the granddaughter walks up to him and says, "Granddad, how can you give me this car? What about your dream car?" And then he says, "Well, this is my dream car." Because now he is investing in relationships. And that's what we are called to do as Christians. If you've never made that commitment, now is the time for you as a person to commit your life to Christ. This congregation will pray for you and encourage you as well if you would come forward. As we stand together and sing hymn number 503, "Since Jesus Came Into My Heart," let us stand together, make our commitments, and sing.